Today, things are now getting really interesting. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And as it's Friday, I have Tarek Brooker with me again. Hi, Tarek.
Hey, Martin, how are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Interesting times again, a lot of things going on and a lot of wobbles around.
Well, I suppose that's pretty much how you could sum up things in their entirety. Things are getting quite wobbly. And, you know, it's not just here in Australia, it's around the world. It's, you know, the Chinese property market where prices are now falling at a fairly significant clip. And, you know, you look at the US with its supply chain issues. Either way, you know, it's just problems all around.
And I chuckled yesterday when the CPI from the US came out, right? And little by little, more and more of the analysts are saying, you know, this transitory inflationary stuff, maybe it's not quite so transitory.
It's kind of funny because I remember back in, I think it was one of the first presentations I did for you with the slides back in, I think it was late May, we talked about how inflation and how supply chain issues and all these things were going to create rather significant problems. And now it seems like the rest of the world's finally catching up.
Yeah, well, they should have watched our show, Tarek, clearly.
Well, you know, perhaps they might learn something. But it's really quite interesting to watch it all just unfold because, you know, in a lot of ways, I mean, this may sound funny to those of you who think of me as a permabear, but things are turning out even worse than I expected. You know what I mean? With, you know, looking at things like natural gas prices in Europe up 900%.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The European situation with regard to energy is quite fascinating. And interestingly, I know a number of people, because I've got quite a lot of contacts over there, whose electricity suppliers have just disappeared. Now, they have this fallback scheme whereby somebody else can step in and provide electricity, but they're having to do it at a loss. So it was ridiculous. They've really wrecked the energy market over there too.
They have, and I think that this just speaks to a failure of strategic planning. Like I remember early, you know, it would have probably been like 3 or 4 months ago now, you know, people were making fun of the Chinese for having power cuts because they, you know, basically just didn't have enough coal. They didn't prepare themselves sufficiently for the demand that would come. And everyone was going, ha ha, look at them, aren't they stupid? And now it's happening across the world. It's happening across Europe. It's happening in India. It's happening in China. It's happening in Brazil. It's happening, you know, in all four corners of the globe.
Absolutely. Well, supply chain disruptions are even hitting Australia because people are complaining they can't get what they normally get. And in fact, I went down the shops the other day and I couldn't get any milk.
Well, that's, you know, that's just the, you know, path of the course at this point. You know, the world was never prepared for everything to be switched off and then suddenly switch back on again. You know, it's not like a piece of technology where that's the absolute best thing you can do. You know, by turning it all off and then turning it all back on again, we've created any number of different issues and problems and unforeseen consequences. And then we threw tens of trillions of dollars at the economy as well. So, you know, we've created this monster of a thing. And no one really knows when all these issues are going to be resolved. I mean, you had like the, you know, one of the executives from Maersk, who's one of the biggest shipping and logistics companies in the world, basically saying we need demand destruction if these supply chain issues are going to be resolved anytime soon.
Scary thought, isn't it? And it's fascinating if you think about, you know, I don't know, a pair of trainers, right? Most of them are made from many different parts from very different manufacturers, and then those parts are shipped around the world and they're sort of put together, you know, maybe 50 to 100 parts, and then they're shipped down here. And so with the time you've got your pair of trainers here in Australia, you know, the logistics and supply chain that represents is scarily complex, and that's just a simple product.
It is. And when you start to look at more complex things with, you know, I mean, like not just a pair of runners, but something like complex, like a piece of machinery, it becomes even more complex because you've got all of these, you know, all these little widgets, all these little parts and things that you don't really think much about in, you know, in everyday life. But when production's been switched off, when demand has been ramped up, it all of a sudden it becomes an issue. Like even Rio Tinto came out today and said that parts shortages are starting to become a significant issue in terms of how much iron ore they're going to be able to dig out of the ground, which could become a major problem for Australia's GDP because iron ore export volumes are one of the key inputs.
That's right. And often it's the weakest link, isn't it? It doesn't have to be necessarily, you know, the total machine. But if one component of that machine falls over and you can't get a replacement, you know, unless you can print it, you know, on these, you know, flatbed printers and, you know, create something temporarily, you're stuck. You really don't have a solution.
No, you don't. And that's one of the problems with this, you know, give the contract to the lowest bidder, just-in-time logistics system that we have, because all of a sudden you can create these problems whereby you just can't solve them. They're not something that can be solved quickly. It's something that takes time, it takes capital, and it takes a commitment to manufacture more. But by the same token, you look at it from the manufacturer's perspective, they're just like, well, I'm worried about a glut. I'm worried about making too much and creating a deflationary scenario. So, you know, it's really something that's very difficult to balance for these manufacturers and just for the global economy more broadly.
Yeah, I was talking to someone the other day who acquired a 3D printer because they decided that that was the best way to make sure that they could make bits if they needed to make bits. And then they discovered they couldn't get the filaments to be able to feed the 3D printer because there was a supply chain problem. So it just shifted the problem.
Well, the shifting of the problem is one of the things that we're starting to see at the moment in the US, because, you know, there's this idea that the only thing that's stopping the US from functioning normally is that they can't get the goods off the ships or into the ports and into the interior fast enough. And that's not correct. There's a whole host of other issues with not enough truck drivers, not enough truck chassis for these shipping containers, not enough logistics spaces, not enough warehouses. You know, we've seen roughly 4 to 5 years of import goods growth occur in about 12 to 18 months. And I've got a chart later in the slideshow that I'll show, you know, just how serious that has been over, you know, since the pandemic began.
Well, a great segue. Why don't we get those charts flowing? Because people love your charts, Tarek. They love your charts.
Well, that's good to hear. All right. Well, then we've got a little nice little cartoon here about the supply chain issues and how, you know, it might be a little bit hard to get for Santa to get all the goodies this year.
It's a great one, isn't it? We're out of everything, pretty much, it says.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, I mean, even coal. So, I mean, at least Scott Morrison should be happy. Okay, this is an interesting one. Chinese housing prices have started falling, largely since the Evergrande saga became, well, the Evergrande saga, which is, you know, basically the Chinese property version of the never-ending story. And as you can see in the sort of wider, you know, Chinese metropolises, which is the top 51 cities, housing prices are starting to fall quite significantly. You know, we've seen housing prices fall more than 3% in total over the last 3 months, and price falls are accelerating. And this comes at a time that total housing sales in the top 10 Chinese cities are down by about 44%. And also it was reported this morning by the Chinese government that of the various auctions that the local government does to release land to developers, only 17% of those developers who bought at auction these development sites are actually non-state owned or state funded enterprises. So we're seeing something almost like a stealth nationalization of the Chinese property sector, because they're the only ones who are willing to pay the prices necessary to get the Chinese government to release this land.
Yeah, and just one point there, Tarek. Of course, Evergrande is one example, right? But it is the entire property sector that's now creaking, isn't it?
It is. There was a great chart the other day posted by your mate George Gammon on Twitter, and he was, you know, basically it's just the entirety of the highly leveraged, you know, junk bond issuing end of the spectrum issuing these bonds who are just in deep trouble. You're seeing these. I mean, Evergrande has sort of been this gradual, you know, decline as it became clear what its impact was and would be on the industry. But some of these other bonds for these smaller property developers, on one hand, some of them have already blown up and they're blowing up behind the scenes every day, which is further complicating access to credit for these Chinese property developers. But it's also the fact that even like the low and mid-tier developers, are seeing the value of their bonds, and some of them have halved, and it's really signaling some quite significant stresses.
And one other quick point on that. Bloomberg, I think, published a chart yesterday that showed nearly half of all junk bonds around the world are actually directly associated with the property sector in China.
Well, that just sort of points out exactly how much a slowdown in the Chinese property sector could really start to hit everything. But I have a few other slides on that, and we'll get to that shortly. Now, this one really just shows exactly how vulnerable the Chinese property sector is. Now, this isn't the latest data, because unfortunately there isn't any more data, but this is the latest available data that shows that roughly 85% of homes purchased in 2018 in China were purchased by basically property speculators, people who already have more than one home. So if you remove the rising property prices, you remove that wealth effect from the economy and the desire to speculate, it's easy to see Chinese housing starts absolutely fall off a cliff, because there's only so much demand there from people who just want a home to live in.
That's a scary thought, isn't it? And people complain about the Australian property market being driven by investors, but China's even worse.
It is, and that's one of the really concerning things for Australia going forward. Because, I mean, let's just imagine that say 70% of those property speculate, well, actually, let's call it 50% of those property speculators are going to continue to speculate. They believe hook, line, and sinker that everything's going to be fine, everything's always going to be fine, and they're just going to keep buying regardless, because property is a road to wealth. And, they're basically the Australian mindset. If housing, if those, if that other 50% or 40% stop buying, that's going to send housing starts plummeting for a start. And that's also going to hit iron ore, it's going to hit copper, it's going to hit coking coal, it's going to hit all these industrial commodities that flow into the Chinese property sector. And the number one supplier of those commodities is Australia. So we've really leveraged our property sector on top of their property sector. And if these people stop buying in anything approaching those types of numbers, we've got a big problem.
Well, it's another example of the old supply chain connections that we talked about previously, right? Upstream, downstream, right? If people are actually changing upstream demand, that has huge impacts, earlier in the value chains. And unfortunately, Australia's holding lots of the cards.
We are, and I mean that's really just the crux of the issue for the Aussie economy going forward. I mean, if you we have had a quite a good time during the pandemic. I know it may sound, I know it may sound a little bit silly. In fact, it may sound very silly, but the thing is, by the borders staying closed, we have generally benefited quite strongly. We've benefited from spending. We've benefited from the government stimulus, and obviously, lockdowns and stuff are a completely different kettle of fish, but purely from an economic perspective, we've come out of this a lot better than a lot of other countries. But as we reopen, as we become reliant on the previous sources of economic growth and economic activity here in Australia, things are going to get a little bit more challenging, particularly when these commodity price upticks, or skyrocketings, should I say, begin to reverse as the world finally does get its crap together. But the thing is, even if you just look at the microcosm of services trade with China, and you look at things, say, like international students or tourism, if you purely look at the spending of of Chinese tourists and purely the fees paid by Chinese international students, you put those two together, you're looking at about $25 billion, which is about 1.25% of all Aussie GDP. And that's quite a lot. And not only that, but if you factor in as well that there are 215,000 Australian, sorry, 215,000 Chinese international students in Australia who need to be housed, who need to be fed, who need to who go out and consume within our economy, it's not hard to see how things could get quite challenging quite quickly if they don't come back, particularly given the diplomatic issues we're having with Beijing.
Well, we were a one-trick pony with regard to those relationships, and unfortunately, if they do shrink and become less important, that's going to have a very significant impact on the broader economy here, isn't it?
Exactly. It also removes whatever leverage we have. If all of a sudden, if China doesn't need our iron ore to that degree, and it's a much more diversified market, then it's going to be co then obviously prices are going to have to come down significantly. I mean, don't get me wrong, the Aussie miners are still going to make a lot of money because they're, amongst the lowest cost producers in the world. But in terms of, this basically, hooking up to the money printer with the iron ore exports, it's, those days may be numbered if these scenarios come to pass.
Absolutely. Watch those prices.
Well, this is a good one. The property the default rate amongst Chinese property developers is just
Horrible.
gone absolutely through the roof. I mean, I don't even think I need to really provide any commentary here. I think the chart pretty much speaks for itself.
Well, that is remarkable. And, the momentum is definitely for more defaults ahead, not less, isn't it?
Indeed, and it's only going to get more challenging. I mean, I'm not sure if you saw today, but the Chinese government came out and said that Chinese banks are now allowed to sell residential mortgage-backed securities again after it banned them previously. And all of a sudden, they're trying to encourage banks to lend, but with property sales falling off something of a cliff, I'm not really sure how successful that's going to be.
Well, and of course, they did reduce the capital ratios the banks had to have earlier on to try and make it easy, even easier for the banks. And again, this shows you the structural connectivity between property developers, for example, and the finance system. And it reminds me of 2008 all over again.
Well, I mean, I think anyone who has watched The Big Short remembers what exactly happened with residential mortgage-backed securities. And I think it's going to be interesting, especially, to see exactly what investors are going to do because, you've got Chinese property prices falling by, 1.6, 1.7% a month at this point, which is, you annualize that, it's a pretty significant sort of fall at this rate. So, I mean, I don't think there'd be too many people who'd be rushing out to buy them, at least too many rational people. But, in the search for yield, you can't really rule it out.
Well, what happens, of course, is with securitization is they put it in different tranche risks, right? So they basically have a very, very high yielding, high risk, structure at the top end, and then they have a series of tiers and tranches and lower risk further down. The trouble is, if you end up with most of it sitting in those high risk ones, the price is going to be huge, and that means that you don't get much value from doing it. So it can become self-defeating.
Well, or you will see that the standard mode of operation from Chinese ratings agencies, and they'll just like they rated some of these completely junk companies like coal miners and property developers AA or A, and then all of a sudden they're in default, and you're like, wait a minute, how is it possible that this A rated company, well, not this single A rated company, these dozens of A rated companies are all of a sudden in this level of trouble?
Well, I have this theory about ratings agencies, which are they tend to be very rear view mirror-ish, and of course they're also very much wanting to get the business, and they get fees for doing it. So, how objective are they really, I wonder?
Well, especially in China, with this company needs credit, do the right thing by the government and all that.
Absolutely.
Now, this is one that's concerning for basically anyone who lives on this planet, and it shows that the producer prices at the factory gate in China are rising by about or almost 11%, which is the highest level in 26 years. And for the moment, Chinese companies are absorbing these higher costs, and you can see that in the fact that the Chinese CPI is actually less than 1% year on year. But the issue with that is, do they start passing those rising costs onto foreign consumers, and does China start to export inflation overseas? Now, obviously, they've got to be competitive with the rest of the world, and they can't, just jack up their prices willy-nilly. But by the same token, everyone's feeling price pressures, and you're seeing across various different industries people raising prices regardless whether they're in, Vietnam or Bangladesh or Turkey, just because there are rising costs. So if China joins that particular party, then we could see global inflation become significantly more entrenched, and that will really do some damage to the Fed and to the RBA's transitory inflation narrative.
Well, it goes back to this concept of inflation being embedded or not, right? And that's actually quite important for people to understand, right? Because what it means is that as more and more things get more expensive, those cascade through into the next part of the supply chains and the value chains. And ultimately, you can get to the point where, in fact, inflation is just locked in. It's something which you will not be able to actually contain.
Well, that's really one of the big risks going forward for really the entire world, but particularly countries that are ex or how you know or households that are heavily exposed to high levels of debt, like Australia. And really, the issue is that the only real weapon we have to control inflation is higher rates. I mean, okay, there is obviously things like higher taxes and stuff like that, but trying to get a government to raise taxes is like it's trying, trying to herd cats. It's just not gonna happen unless you've got a very cohesive society that's prepared to accept that sort of shared sacrifice. But in most of the world, where especially where people are already over-leveraged and already have significant financial commitments, it's pretty hard to see them being able to do that. And that's what makes all this so concerning, just more broadly, because they may be forced into a position that they have to crush inflation, which is arguably going to potentially cause one of the biggest financial busts in all of history, because it's just everyone. I mean, okay, maybe they're going to be able to monetize government debt and they're going to be able to bail out sovereigns, at least some of them. But in terms of households and corporates, if they've got to really stomp on this inflation and raise rates, I mean, it's practically unimaginable, really, trying to fully grasp the breadth and the scope of how much damage that could really do.
Well, you've put your finger there on the absolute dilemma that central banks have, right? Because what they would like is actually inflation to go up a bit, because that would actually devalue the amount of debt that's in the system. But on the other hand, government debt is such an important part of the economy at the moment, and those very low rates are helping to make it the funding feasible. Because if rates started to go up, governments had to pay a lot more for it. So they're actually caught between trying to actually bring a little bit of inflation to bear, on the other hand, trying to keep interest rates low. They've backed themselves into this really wacky corner.
Well, to be completely honest with you, I don't know how possible it is to be able to engage in this sort of inflate away the debt type strategy. I mean, I've been doing a little bit of research into, just sort of how inflation and consumer spending and household savings have all interacted with each other over, say, like the last 50 or 60 years. But the thing is, there just isn't the slack in household budgets to absorb these rising costs in the way that there was in the 1970s or the 1980s, because people just don't have that much slack in the budget. They don't have, they don't save the way they used to. I mean, if you look back on household savings rates between the 1960s and the 1980s here in Australia, household savings rates were 10 to 20%. And today, once you take superannuation out of the equation, and you sort of factor out that big uptick that occurred because of COVID, savings rates are at or below zero for most of the last 20 years. So there just isn't that ability for households to absorb those rising costs without it really flowing into the economy and also just starting to really undermine their personal financial security.
Absolutely. And the only way out of that is to have higher wages, right? But if you have higher wages, that's inflationary.
Exactly. So it's that real chicken and the egg sort of issue that central banks have. And, really, I think that in a lot of ways, like, I mean, I know they want inflation because, that's really the only path out of this high debt scenario, aside from a default or something along those lines, because it's not going to be paid down. But realistically, I think in the end, they may end up begging for it because, they don't have the desirable tools to deal with this situation.
No, and I make the point also that if in fact growth continues to languish, I mean, the IMF came out this week with a report that said, well, growth is going to be lower. And if in fact the inflationary pressures are also, forcing a lot of other things to happen. We could actually end up with a deflationary rather than an inflationary momentum, simply because the amount of credit will start going down. And if credit goes down, then it's all over Red Rover.
Well, it's also just there's the credit side of things, as you say. I mean, there's, you know, the stag part of stagflation, which is, you know, the declining growth. And I mean, if the Atlanta Fed's forecast for just 0.3% or 0.33%, should I say, growth for the US economy in Q3 is correct, I mean, that puts America on an absolutely disastrous trajectory. You know, after spending all these trillions and trillions and trillions and having all these households run down their savings over the last few months, if that's the best they can do with all that stimulus, what's it going to be like next year when the fiscal cliff arrives?
That's correct. And of course, some of the Feds have stopped now casting because they didn't like the answers they were getting.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's just gold. All right. Now, this is an interesting one, just in the broader inflationary debate. Now, US rents have basically gone through the absolute roof. The CPI hasn't really done a fantastic job of measuring it. As far as it's concerned, rents have only risen by about 3.2% over the past 12 months, while various different indices, you know, Zillow, Apartment List, and a plethora of others have put rental inflation at somewhere between 12 and 16%. The CPI continues to insist that it's 3.2% and everything's fine. Now, one of the main reasons this is because of what they call owner equivalent rent. Because if you own a property, you obviously don't pay rent, and they instead ask that proportion of people who own their own home to then estimate how much their property could be rented for. And they tend to be, you know, sort of a relatively lagging indicator. But when people start to realize that we are in an inflationary environment, at least for the time being, you could see that begin to reverse quite significantly and quite violently potentially as well. Because basically, because it's driven by psychology and how people perceive the rental value of their home, if they hear about inflation, they hear about things going up, basically what you could end up with is a self-fulfilling prophecy, in the same way that has occurred in the past with inflation expectations coming true.
Well, and that's very interesting because, of course, inflation the CPI used to include a different set of measures for housing, right? And some years ago, around the world, those were taken out and this sort of proxy owner equivalent rental thing came in its stead, which understates quite often the real true costs of housing. And somebody asked me the other day, could I calculate the CPI in Australia based not on the current methodology, but on the methodology that was used, you know, 20, 30 years ago? And I've started that project. It's quite complex because, of course, some of the rules have changed and some of the data no longer exists. But what I can tell you is that if you actually were to put the old metrics back in to measure property and housing, the CPI would be a lot higher in Australia than it currently is.
Well, I can imagine. So would that include housing price appreciation in the calculation?
Yes, it would.
Yep. Okay. Well, I can only imagine what that would look like, considering the fact that housing prices have apparently absolutely gone to the moon.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, there was a policy decision taken around the world to take that out of the of the CPI, right? So now, think about that for a second. If, in fact, the CPI is really bigger, then all these very low, ultra low interest rates around the world are actually way too low, because effectively they're targeting a 2-3% target that's actually not real.
Well, you know, I think that governments just go looking for the outcomes they desire. I mean, that's why, if you look at why during the Eurozone debt crisis, the EU and a bunch of other countries around the world suddenly decided that illegal activity like prostitution and drug dealing and all this other sort of stuff was suddenly going to be included in gross domestic product, and they gave their economies a nice little boost.
Yes, totally objective government data. Not sure that exists, actually. It seems to me that they do actually have an end outcome in mind. It's a bit like when you have a public inquiry, you always write the terms of reference, knowing what you want by way of the result.
Well, or you just, sort of put the hard word on the people who did it, and then just water it down into oblivion, like certain ones that I won't mention because of a potential defamation lawsuit.
Absolutely.
Now, this is the chart I was referring to, showing how US imports have absolutely rocketed ahead during the pandemic, and we've basically seen years and years of growth just crammed into a very, very short period of time. And that's also been complicated by the fact that US imports have been relatively flat over the last couple of years. So there hasn't really been that requirement to, expand logistics, to train truck drivers, to, make sure there's sufficient chassis and rail capacity to be able to move all these goods. And now all of a sudden you've thrown, these extra trillions and trillions of dollars into the mix, the system just wasn't ready for it. And even if they do manage to solve these problems at the ports, not just in America, but globally, if the internal logistics train isn't sufficient, you're going to end up with the same problem. It's just going to spread even wider. And the reality is if you can't fill a warehouse in Milwaukee, it's not going to matter that the ship is sitting there in Los Angeles, because you're not going to be able to get the stuff off the ship because there's not going to be the space for it in the first place.
It goes back to this cascading set of failures, right? Because of course, all the bottlenecks just keep building on each other. The other point to make, of course, in the US, they've been buying things, right, as opposed to services. And some of the latest information coming out of that CPI data suggested maybe there's a bit of a switch back now as things have reopened and maybe services are beginning to take off. But the US consumer has been buying a lot of things. A lot of those things, of course, were paid for by government money.
Well, that's really the challenge in all of this. It's, you know, you're seeing all of these enormous supply chain issues, these shortages of, everything from cars to tiny little widgets to the componentry and any number of different products. Say, for example, like the chips, which are, curtailing Apple's iPhone production. But the reality is that these issues are not easily solvable. And part of the problem in all this is that once they are solved, and once they do resume production at this level to fulfill this demand, you're basically baking in a disinflation or perhaps even deflationary scenario. Because the reality is that, gas in Europe isn't always going to be 900% more expensive than in 2020. You're not always going to be able to justify all these enormous price rises as things return to normal. And that's once again where the stagflationary issue comes in, because consumer confidence in the US has fallen off a cliff. And one of the key drivers of that is inflation, and the fact that people feel like they can't afford a car, they can't afford a house, they can't afford the durable goods at those current prices.
Well, that's right. And in fact, forward expectations for inflation from consumers, both here and in the US, haven't been as high as they've been currently for a long, long time.
That's one of the things I think is interesting about the Westpac Time to Buy a Dwelling Index, which is, really fallen off a cliff, dropped something like 32% over the last 12 months. So, I mean, I do wonder if over time Australians perhaps may begin to feel similarly to Americans, just that things are too unaffordable and that they've had enough. Although, I don't know, maybe we're gluttons for punishment here in Australia with our rising housing prices that are celebrated around barbecues across the nation.
Oh, no, property will always go up. It goes up religiously. There's no ifs and buts about it, right? Most people believe property prices will ultimately always go up. And they also believe that the government will save them. In other words, the government will always do things to keep property prices going up. That is a fundamental religion wired into the psyche of most Australians.
Well, I can't unfortunately disagree with you there as much as I would like to, but it is something to really, think about going forward, just because, people often ask me about housing prices and, about, on a more personal note, and obviously I don't give that type of advice, but, I think part of the problem with all this going forward is how much more of our taxpayer money is the government willing to burn at you know at the altar of high property prices? And the answer is I really don't know.
Well, it's a lot, isn't it? And the Victorian announcement last week that they're going to now do basically shared equity. In other words, taxpayers' money is going to make up the difference between what, 75% and 100% or something like that, right? Another example of yet again taxpayers' money flowing through the system to be able to support the property sector, to be able to support price house prices. And I keep saying this, it's a zero-sum game, because of course all that happens is that prices go up by the amount of the stimulus that's actually thrown in. You saw it over in Western Australia, you see it wherever you look. This is a stupid, stupid thing that we got ourselves into, but governments just keep doing it.
Well, that's something that I think we need to explore and get into more as a not just obviously you and I, but just as a nation, and I think it really just points out how basically, well, I'm just going to come out and say it, how screwed we are, to be completely honest with you. I mean, we are in a nation where $93 billion a year is pulled out in the form of home equity. Now, that's very nearly two of all of Kevin Rudd's stimuluses, which was spread out over about 3 years. So you've got two times stimulus, Rudd's almost two times Rudd's stimulus, except it's every year instead of spread over 3 years. Or it's about eight times all of Rudd's cash handouts. So, it crammed in every single year solely from equity, mate. So the problem is that if property prices stop rising, people are less able to take advantage of that. And obviously, if property prices fall, then they really can't take advantage of that. And you're pulling, 4.6% of GDP out of the economy. And, like that, it's gone. And not only that, but if it reverses and people start paying down their mortgage instead of borrowing against them, well, then you've really got an even bigger problem. So, I mean, I think that's really the issue here, that, there are no good options anymore. We've passed that point.
I tend to agree with you on that one, and certainly in my surveys, there are some people still paying down their mortgages, good on them, but there are a lot more, as you say, pulling more equity out. And as prices rise higher, of course, it allows the bank of mum and dad to throw money to the next generation. It allows you to, put another room on, or granny flat, or whatever. But just remember, folks, that interest rates may not be as low as they currently are into the future. And so those bigger mortgages could start costing a lot more. And that will be another negative factor in terms of economic momentum.
Indeed. I mean, the thing at the moment is that there is so much uncertainty. Things could go either way. We could see a deflationary scenario beginning as soon as towards the end of the year. I don't think that that's likely at this point, but I think it's possible, and it's possible that we could see an inflationary scenario where inflation continues for at least another couple of years. So, all these things are on the table, and I think one of the things that people really need to remember is that Philip Lowe is not God when it comes to interest rates. As much as he is sort of presented like that with his promises of we're not going to touch it for 3 years and all that business. Not long ago, I think it was about in May or June, the Bank of England was like, no rate hikes until 2023. And now the Bank of England are like, potential rate hike in December this year. And that's what the market is now pricing in. There's even the market now pricing in rate hikes potentially as early as late Q3 in the US next year. So if this inflation thing really keeps going globally, you're going to have some rather major problems. And Philip Lowe is eventually going to be dragged kicking and screaming to hike rates, whether he wants to or not, if that does end up happening.
So, folks, Philip Lowe isn't God. Now, there's a very interesting observation I've got there, because when Mr. Lowe turns out with his edicts, be they speeches or whether they're the monthly notes, right? And he's given the odd press conference. But have you noticed how gentle all the press coverage is, and how all the questions are very, very tame? There's nobody who asks a hard question. So I got this vision of Mr. Lowe coming off the mountain with these tablets, right, with the latest, greatest, right? And everybody says, all hail the great Lowe, and they just sort of, take it and translate it. And then you've got all these economists who spend all of their time parsing every word, and it's a religion. It's not economics anymore.
Oh, sometimes I watch these ones in the US, where Powell gets grilled by the media. Well, grilled, you know, like it should be gently caressed by the media, you know, and nobody ever asks him the tough questions, you know, like I just wish that they would. I wish that they'd get up there and just take the wrecking ball to him like they should, because, you know, they are, the Fed is screwing up the world. And like, I understand why they had to do what they did to a degree. You know, okay, they didn't want the global economy to completely implode and for it to fall into a depression. I get that. But they could have said in, like, you know, the let's call it late Q3 last year, they could have started walking back some of their rhetoric. None of this investors, everybody gets made whole crap. They could have said, we're no longer going to be backing corporate bonds that don't need our assistance. And that wouldn't have changed anything, because they never bought that many corporate bonds in the first place. But it would have at least sent that much needed signal. And just, you know, we're not going to support the market. You know, the market is the market, and we should allow things to play out organically. Even just coming out and saying that would have changed things dramatically. But instead, it's just, you know, further fodder for the printer goes brewer crowd, who just seem to believe that the Fed will always save them.
Mm, and that always save them is, of course, absolutely true for investors and corporates and pretty much everybody, actually, other than, you know, ordinary Americans, or here in Australia, ordinary Australians, who are fighting a very significant pressure when it comes to costs versus incomes. But, you know, the corporate guys, the big end of town, they all basically have a get-out-of-jail card free from the central banks.
Well, they do until they don't. That's the way I see it. You know, I mean, if this inflationary stuff does continue, I mean, look, you know, not that long ago, you know, probably like last year, I thought that there would be, you know, sort of deflation in consumer goods this year. But that was until that both Trump and then Biden threw more money at the economy, and Morrison, I might add. But the way I see it is that if this inflation is now baked in, or even if it's not baked in, even if this inflationary impulse only continues for another 9 or 12 months, that's more than enough time to force the Fed into raising rates and into just completely shattering this idea that they're always going to be there. And instead, you know, they may go from being the hero of the story to the villain.
Or actually, is it more likely that they'll have a go at tapering? And then just like a few years ago, the market said, no, we're not going to allow that, right? So the market start falling, and then the Fed comes back and says, okay, we'll do a bit more then.
If we didn't have inflation, I would wholeheartedly agree with you. But with the inflationary issues, all of a sudden it's becoming a very, very political and politicized issue. You know, you've already got Joe Manchin, you know, beating the drum on ending QE as soon as possible. And I think, especially as we head into next year and the midterm election cycle, you know, if they've got some problems, and Democrats really need someone to scapegoat in all this, particularly because they keep putting their foots in their mouth. Like, did you see that tweet from Biden's chief of staff yesterday?
I did.
You know, these are not basically, to sum up for the viewers, it was basically just, you know, these are not major, inflation is a problem for the higher class, not for low class,
not for ordinary people.
And it's like, are you kidding me? It's like, are you literally just trying to hand the election to the Republicans? I mean, you've got to be an idiot to say something like that.
I know.
Anyway, we should probably get to the next slide. Now, this one I think is interesting, and it's another one that supports the inflationary theory, at least to some degree. Well, actually, it more supports the stagflationary theory in actual fact. But U.S. labor force participation is at its lowest level since 1977. And after this initial bounce back that was created, you know, when the U.S. economy reopened after the initial lockdowns, it's basically really gone nowhere, which is really quite concerning. Because it shows that people just aren't wanting to get back into the workforce. Now, there are a lot of questions and a lot of theories as to why, but the reality is that the further labor force participation falls, the less economic potential a country has, because these people are no longer actively producing value within the economy through their labor. And not only that, but this is now at its lowest level since 1977, a time when women were still, becoming to into enter the workforce, you know, particularly in the US. So that's something that could create inflation in the sense that there are just fewer workers willing to engage in the labor force. So getting to full employment could occur a lot more quickly, and we could see pressure on wages a lot more swiftly as well. So that's something that's really going to be interesting to watch over the next, well, the coming months and the coming years, because if these are permanent shifts, if people have suddenly decided, well, I don't want to work that much, I'd rather spend more time with my children, or I'd rather spend my time pursuing something else because I have the money, or because I've played the stock market, or I've won big on betting on crypto. If they're not no longer engaging with the economy, then you could see, weaker potential growth and higher potential wages, which could be a really, really interesting set of circumstances.
Well, we're seeing the same thing here with the participation rate decreasing and more people effectively checked out from the workforce. Questions, will they check in again later? And, actually, a lot of the statistics around, employment and things are really, really very, very wobbly at the minute because of this. But I think this participation rate question is a really important one. There are lots of people who have checked out and they may not check back in here.
No, and that may be, just a permanent structural change. And it could, not only that, but, with working from home and even people working fewer hours and working part-time, this could actually be even understating that issue. And it could actually be even more serious than it appears.
Absolutely. Could well be.
Now, this is what I call one of the most concerning charts in the world on Twitter it probably would have been about a week ago now. And basically, it shows that the price of fertilizer in the US is heading for, well, it is at a record high now. And with the gas crisis that's going on in Europe and elsewhere, natural gas is one of the key components in manufacturing fertilizer. So plants in Britain, plants and in Europe have been closed because basically they cannot economically make fertilizer with gas prices where they are. So that's obviously creating, this compression in the market, which is causing prices to rise. And we're only just seeing the beginning of that now. If this gas crisis does continue, if the Northern Hemisphere has a particularly cold winter, or if Vladimir Putin just doesn't really want to play ball, we could see fertilizer prices really take off like some of these other commodities into the stratosphere. And that feeds directly into global food prices, particularly in developing nations. But it could also hit inflation in the US and here in Australia and make our shopping that much more expensive and really create some problems for the RBA and the other central banks when it comes to interest rates.
Well, a great example of an input cost, right? So effectively, it's a fundamental part of agriculture. And, if those prices continue to rise, they've got no choice because they'll have to pass those costs on through the supply chain, into the stock, into the shops. Again, it shows you precisely what we were talking about earlier on, how all of these elements cascade forward and effectively end up with more price pressures at the end of the chain. And ultimately, the consumer is the one who picks it up.
It is. And one of the biggest problems with food prices is that if you look at food prices alongside social stability indices, they can track quite strongly. And if we do see fertilizer prices head off into the stratosphere like gas or like lumber or iron ore, you're going to see this bring down governments. I mean, I know that may sound like I'm a doomsayer, but it has done before and it will do again. And it's just food, putting food on the table for your family is one of the most, it is arguably the most essential thing. And if you take that away from people, particularly in the developing world where they've already been struggling because of COVID, because of inflation, it may not be a very, very pretty picture in the months and years to come if this trend continues and isn't addressed.
No, I agree with that. It's very, very critical to watch. And as you say, social unrest is just over the hill. Well, Tarek, that was tremendous. And, again, what's so interesting is that how all of these pieces of the jigsaw puzzle point in a similar direction, right? Which is that effectively we know we've got issues with supply chains. You can look at it wherever you go and you can see some of the same issues. You can see how central banks are pretty much caught now between, you know, the devil and the deep blue sea with regard to what to do. My question, though, is what's the political impact of all of this, do you think? Do you think, you know, people are just going to sort of shrug their shoulders and move on, or do you think this has potential political impact as well?
Do you mean like the supply chain side of things or the inflation side or both of them combined?
Well, I was thinking of, you know, if you put it holistically together, you can see all of these elements working, right? But so far, the politicians have managed to stay out of it pretty much, haven't they?
Here in Australia, broadly speaking, yes. Basically because, you know, Australians are a relatively easy lot to please, to be completely honest with you. You know, as long as you're not actively screwing something up, people seem relatively happy to just, as long as the government isn't interfering in their lives too much. Well, even if they are. But in the US, it's really hitting Biden's approval rating. Biden's approval rating got smashed after Afghanistan, and it hasn't recovered. And inflation is one of the key reasons why that's occurring. And not only that, but even these supply chain issues are really starting to put pressure on him. And to be completely honest with you, they have no idea what they're doing. You know, like I read these things from these, you know, experts on supply chains and stuff who are basically saying that this could take years and years to resolve because it's an enormously complex problem with a lot of different inputs. And if the government just throws more money at it, it's only going to make things more complex and potentially even more protracted. But, you know, Biden comes out and goes, oh, well, I'm going to make Walmart's and FedEx's supply chain work 24/7. Well, it's like, well, Joe, they were already 24/7. You haven't accomplished anything. You just made an announcement. You're taking a leaf out of Scott Morrison's book. And that's really the issue in all of this, because none of this is easily solvable. Even, I mean, yes, obviously politicians could do a lot to solve it, but that requires a fair amount of introspection, a fair amount of assessment, and, you know, discussions with people who actually know what they're talking about. But to be completely honest with you, that's not really happening. I mean, perhaps it is behind the scenes, but there isn't really much public sign of that occurring. But I think that particularly in Europe, the gas crisis could really cause some major, major problems. Particularly in France, of all places, because they've got an election coming up next year. And, you know, not being able to heat your house or having extremely high heating bills coming just as you get to an election is potentially a great way to lose. Particularly, you know, if you do see the rise of a populist left or even right-wing candidate in the upcoming elections.
Well, that's why I asked, because it seems to me that if I look at, for example, the UK and Boris, you know, what they've done in the last few weeks is they've, you know, put their head up above the parapet and tried to solve a particular bit of the problem. You know, they gave some money to the people producing CO2, for example, to try and solve that. And then they sort of said, well, maybe we'll help some of the, you know, the steel makers over here. And they're sort of throwing bits and pieces all over the place at the same time as they're actually withdrawing some of the low-level support for individual households, right? And it's beginning to look like they actually have no idea what they're doing. Now, maybe that was always true, but it seems to me that these sorts of intractable issues that we're now seeing, right, which are real dynamic, you know, but real issues in terms of what's really happening out there, right, are different from the broader economic policy issues, which are always sort of nebulous and fluid. These are real issues, right? If, as you say, you can't get, you know, your food on the table or whatever, these are things that really impact individuals and frankly will make a difference as to how they vote and, you know, what they think. I think politicians in a number of countries, perhaps even in Australia, are now starting to tread a very, very fine line, because maybe people are actually getting to the point where they're saying, come on, guys, it's time to actually get serious about doing real things rather than all this stupidity that they spend all their time doing.
I think as long as a government can manage to make things look, you know, like they know what they're doing, they can manage to look like they're at least doing something. I mean, you know, say JobMaker, for example. JobMaker pledged to create 450,000 jobs. It created 1% of that, but nobody gives a crap. Now, you and I care, and I imagine there are quite a few people who are into politics who care, and quite a few viewers that care. But in terms of the average person, they don't really give a crap. You know, they just, it was just like, oh, well, Scott Morrison said he was going to do this, and that's fantastic, and then they just forget about it. But, you know, I think Australia is relatively, well, I don't want to call us lucky. I mean, I suppose we are lucky, purely from the fact that, we don't have all these problems to the same degree as the rest of the world. But, in terms of the US, in terms of Europe, and basically everywhere else on the planet that's experiencing these problems, it's gonna end a lot of leaderships. It's gonna end governments. It's gonna end, it's just gonna be a really challenging time for a lot of people. And I remember we discussed this. I probably would have been the middle of last year how we discussed the similarities with the uncertainty of the 1930s. And I think that that particular call is looking relatively prophetic at this point because. Obviously, the thing that people need to remember is that the 1930s took a long time. We're not saying that, that Nazi Germany is going to invade Poland tomorrow or even that that's going to happen at all. But just that there is that level of uncertainty of economic crises going on behind the scenes that could really create some rather seismic shifts. And, just to go back to China for a moment, if we do see the Chinese property sector go down the gurgler, and if we do start to see, more issues emerge in China, particularly as you see the profits and the profitability of businesses get squeezed and households get squeezed too, you could see all sorts of wacky things happening. You could see, proper, saber rattling over things like Taiwan. You could see, the Chinese sail their entire amphibious fleet, into the Taiwan Strait and scare the absolute crap out of everyone. They may even do it. I don't think that's especially likely in the short term, but it's a possibility. And this is all stuff that's potentially on the horizon. And I don't think that any of it really has been priced in. We're just priced to perfection, both in terms of how things are perceived, and both how and priced by the market.
And that's the point, really, isn't it? The markets are very much on the up at the moment. Not quite at their highs, but quite close to them, because they think that the COVID is now under control, and the worst of it is past. The earnings look pretty good, etc. But it seems to me that they've got some very, very rose tinted spectacles on. Maybe they're Philip Lowe's rose tinted spectacles. That's maybe it's it. Maybe they've got a job lot.
Yeah, no. Well, I think Tony LeCantro made a good point in your chat with him on Tuesday night. That perhaps the end of COVID, the sort of end of the emergency, so to speak, if it does end, in relatively short order over Christmas, as people are hoping, in the Northern Hemisphere and stuff because of vaccinations. Perhaps Tony is correct, and that is the real threat in all of this. That it's sort of buy the rumor, sell the news.
Yeah, we'll see. I tell you what, we always say it's interesting times, right? Always plenty to talk about. So I appreciate your time today once again, Tarek, and the slides as well. And I reckon we should do it all again quite soon.
Well, I'm sure there'll be plenty more to talk about one way or another.
Thanks very much. See you later.
See you later, mate.
Bye.